There is nothing artificial about leadership. As leaders worth following, we must upgrade our relational operating systems. Because real influence comes from leaders who build trust with empathy and insight. LeaderCast presents Human Intelligence with Radhika Dirks, Henry Cloud, Stephanie Chung, Eddie Ndopu, Erica Keswin, Joe Boyd, Andy Stanley, and Jeremy Kubicek. Join us and help fill the world with leaders worth following.
Welcome to the LeaderCast podcast, a weekly deep dive into the stories that transformed our guests into leaders worth following. I'm your host, Joe Boyd. If you've been enjoying the podcast, thank you so much for being a listener. One simple thing you can do to help us out is to give a review on the app wherever you listen. Thanks. Welcome to the LeaderCast podcast. Today's guest is Ian Cron. I'm very excited for you to hear the conversation that I had with Ian. He talks about his recovery journey and the 12 steps and how that shaped him. He talks about growing up as what he calls a feral cat. And we learn about the Enneagram and how he uses it to help people change their lives and help them. Also, I want to let you know, for this particular podcast, Ian has offered you, the listeners, some free gifts, including a free assessment and a free chapter from his new book. So you can get all that information in the details here written below in the description of the podcast. But I'm really excited for you to hear Ian. He goes kind of deep. Let's go there now. Ian Cron, welcome to the LeaderCast podcast. We are so, so happy you're here. You were a presenter at LeaderCast several years ago and went through the 9 Enneagram types in 30 minutes, which I thought was impossible. So thank you for doing that. We are so, so excited to talk to you. I know a ton of people on our platform have been helped by you and by your book, The Road Back for You. What we'd love to do here is just kind of get to know you a little bit. So we'll jump into some Enneagram stuff later. Folks that listen to this know I'm into it. I'll probably like give a warning, like for the next 5 minutes, I'm just going to talk really nerdy about the Enneagram. You can fast forward. We'll do that later. But for now, could you just tell us a little bit of your journey and your story and where you started and how you ended up here now? And then we can dive into some of those specifics as we go.
Sure. Well, I'm a native of Connecticut, which you don't meet many people from Connecticut, I guess. I grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut. I grew up in a pretty troubled family. My father was an alcoholic and a drug addict, died from which he died at 62 years old. But I managed to find my way through life. I was early on very much an artist, deeply into reading, writing, poetry. Songwriting was what mattered to me most as a young man. Then went to college. I majored in English and Romance languages, English literature and Romance languages. Went on. I worked on Young Life staff for a bunch of years. And then, I went to seminary, got a degree in psychotherapy, then another degree in, a master's in divinity, did my doctoral work at Fordham. I started a church. I pastored it for 10 years, became an Episcopal priest, and then moved to Nashville and to be a full-time writer. And so I've got a couple of books under my belt and, that's a very, very fast overview of my life. But
Whenever anyone tells their stories and they laugh, you just know there's a 30-minute thing they just skipped over, right? That's a whole story. Oh. But we'll save it. Yeah. But let's go back. So part of what we do with this podcast, what I try to do is I've been like a storyteller and a story theory guy most of my life. So what we like to do, we don't want to force it, but kind of think about like Joseph Campbell's hero's journey a little bit and how we all kind of go on one, and how it starts off when we're young with some sort of yearning for what he would call like a treasure or whatever. And I know I had read a little that your early life was difficult in many ways. And you mentioned that, if you wouldn't mind, if we could just live there for a few minutes, like going back to young Ian, one of the fun questions I like to ask, were there any like adventure stories or, TV shows or comic books or literature or anything that sort of lived in your heart early on that tapped into that wanting an adventure sort of thing? Do you remember anything like that in your story?
Yeah, I guess, well, two things. One is what you're describing, you know, when you talk about Joseph Campbell, and this is a story that is a correlate to my own, I think, is the story of Pinocchio, which is a consummate Joseph Campbell sort of hero of a thousand faces, sort of a great sort of, how would I say this, archetype, right? It would be what Pinocchio is. There was a mythical fictional character from a book I read maybe in sixth grade. His name was Sam Gribble. He was the central character in a book called My Side of the Mountain. Oh man, it was such a great book. It's about a kid who was living in New York City. And I grew up outside Manhattan, just 30 miles.
Yeah.
But he hated the cramped environment, and he takes off and lives in a mountain by himself. And he's like 12 years old. I mean, he just runs away and lives on this mountain in a, you know, in this, I don't know if it was a tree house. I don't remember, but you know, some sort of self-made hut or something. And it just his journey up on this mountain. And I just so resonated with that character and thought his journey was fascinating and compelling.
Was it do you think it was like you wanting to get out? Like, is that why you resonated, that your environment, you were fantasizing about maybe a different place to be?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I also was a little bit, I was a sweet kid in a lot of ways, you know, but I always had this side to me that was a little bit of a rebel.
Yeah.
And imagined myself in those kinds of situations and positions.
One of the things I read about you described your childhood as feral, like a feral cat. And I've never heard anyone say that. So we're going to camp out on, that's just a good word. So we're going to stay there for just a second. So when do you remember saying that or writing that? Someone showed me that. What do you mean by that? What was going on there?
Well, I mean, it was crazy. I had to raise myself.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have a father. I had to raise myself like a wolf, you know? I mean, it was just kind of a kooky situation. And I had to make my own mistakes and process them on my own, deal with them on my own. So that's what I mean by a feral cat. I mean, it was, it was tough. It was a slog. I really did have an awesome life. I became an adult.
Yeah, right.
I had a difficult beginning, you know?
Yeah. But it's interesting though. I mean, you know this, and you've probably done the work, especially with all your Enneagram work, is early on, that's kind of where whatever we end up, I think, giving to the world gets planted in us pretty early on, often as pain, right? So I think, do you see any of that in your day-to-day work now? If we fast forward, if we showed sixth grade Ian what you're doing right now, do you think, what do you think he might think about that?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I was a very sensitive, I mentioned artistic kid. A little bit of an outsider, you know? And I, again, very artistic. I was a crazy reader. I just was just immersed in literature that was far ahead of my age too, you know, cause I had, my father was actually a great reader and I had much older siblings. And so I was digging into the stuff that they had on their bedside tables. You know, I just would consume literature and music. So here I am, you know, a bunch of years later, I live in Nashville. I write books. I have two bestsellers. I don't say that to credentialize as much as to say what a dream that I'd never anticipated would be. If you had said to me at sixth grade, hey, don't worry, you're living a crappy life right now, but guess what? One day you're going to be married. You're going to have three beautiful kids. You're going to have two bestsellers and you're going to win a Dove Award for writing a great song. And you're going to, all the things you ever dreamed of doing, you're going to do them.
Yeah.
I'd have been like, okay, hold on. It's going to be all right.
Yeah. Could have taken some of the pressure off. we talk about I talk about dragons and how every great story has a dragon to overcome. There's usually like an inner one and an outward one. But as you got older, and to get you from, say, teenage, young 20s, Ian, to where you are now, where you feel pretty great about your life, what would you say was the biggest sort of dragon you had to slay or overcome to get where you are?
Well, I mean, I guess two things. One is I had no choice but to process what I experienced growing up in my 20s. I mean, I really was faced with little choice in the matter, you know? I also, in my late teens, early 20s, developed a drug and alcohol habit that eventually, got me into trouble. Yeah. And, you know, so I had a journey of a dragon with substances. But, you know, it's not even with substances. You know, people tend to, they're much less so today, but they're, you know, people tend to stigmatize people with drug and alcohol problems, but which is quite unfortunate, because that's not really the problem. That's the symptom. Right. The problem really is the unprocessed trauma, which creates the right environment or natural climate for an addiction to develop, you know? And, you know, that's what I learned growing up was,
yeah. Did you use the,
this is the best way to deal with pain.
Yeah. Did you use the 12 steps through that stuff?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And still do. It's been many years, but I still go to, I mean, here in Nashville, I go to 3 meetings, 4 meetings a week.
Oh, you still do? Yeah. Do you mind?
You don't graduate.
Right.
there's no graduating from this program.
I get it. Trust me. I love the 12 steps and like, cause they work. but also I feel like they're very rooted in the human condition and have a way of sort of often bypassing kind of like often religious hangups or things that people have, and just being so simple and yet so profound. Do you mind telling me like how has your recovery journey just shaped? How has it made you who you are in the day to day? Like what, apart from helping you be sober, what's it done for you?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, in the beginning, you know, you go into no one shows up at a 12 step meeting because they're on a winning streak. You know what I'm saying? That is not why people show up, right?
I'm addicted to winning.
That's not why they're there. And you know, you come in and maybe the first line of business is, well, I got to stop using substances. But people have a real misunderstanding about the 12 steps. They think, oh, you know, these are just people who sit around talking about, you know, how do I not drink today? You know, it's like, no, that's not what we talk about. Mm-hmm. Like, it's about how do you live a new manner of life with this new design for living, which is the 12 steps. And how do I become a person who, as the result of a spiritual awakening that is the natural outcome of working these 12 steps, move through the world as a more loving, tolerant, contributive person, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, and to be a person of service and that's what the 12 steps are about. So what happens is that you develop a larger purpose which if you do, your need for substances becomes, you know, it just doesn't exist anymore. The obsession is lifted and your attention migrates toward this other manner of life.
Thanks for going there. I also am a recovering pastor. I did that for a period in my life. And I think as I lead this company, this is a LeaderCast is a place for people of all faith and no faith. It's not a faith-based company, but we're open to people talking about that part of their life because it's such a major part for so many of us. And recovery to me is a similar thing where I think if we can normalize talking about it, it's probably not totally accurate to say everyone's addicted to something, but maybe it is. Do you think it is? But there's something that has power over every one of us that at some point we have to face. How do you feel about the phrase "everyone's addicted to something"?
I believe everyone's addicted to something.
Okay.
Absolutely. I just think it's the human condition.
Yeah.
And everybody has I don't care what it is. It could be you're addicted to work. You're addicted to your relationship or to love itself, right?
Yeah.
You could be, addicted to food. You could be addicted to porn. You could be, I just don't know anybody that doesn't have some kind of addiction. They're in a relationship with something that is more powerful than they are, that they use as a means to address pain in their lives. I could give you a list of hundreds of addictions that people can. In fact, you don't just have one addiction, you have multiple addictions.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They're like, oh no, it's a game of whack-a-mole. Now, the benefit for me as a person who became addicted to alcohol and sort of chemicals was, I would say we're kind of the lucky ones, right?
Yeah.
Because eventually our problems become public. Like they become something that people go, oh, somebody has a problem. And then they wrap you up and they send you away for a period of time to go deal with the underlying causes and conditions of your pain. I actually feel sorry for the poor guy or woman who's a porn addict and is actually trapped in something that they can't get. It's not public. It's a secret. And after a while, there's no intervention. Rarely for that. I mean, sometimes there is, but you know what I'm saying? In other words, I feel sorry for the person who's
even
living
another
in
level,
the dark.
Right. I was just going to say there's even another level where some of the societies we live in idolize certain addictions, right? If I'm addicted to work, success, and making money, mm-hmm. that's not secret. That's something I typically get praised for. So there's even that level.
And people say, oh, well, it doesn't have the same consequences. Okay, so maybe it's not lethal. Although I've known many people who've died of a heart attack or a stroke as a result of overwork, right? Or they've blown their families up as a result of their addiction to work. What's the difference? Yeah. What's the difference between that and, blowing up your marriage because you drink too much?
Yeah.
You don't want the lack of professional development opportunities to cost you top talent. The reality is that all-star employees look for and stay with employers who invest in them and their growth. And one of the easiest ways for you to provide that is by streaming LeaderCast's newest event, Human Intelligence. There is nothing artificial about leadership. Real influence will come from leaders who build trust with empathy and insight. The future belongs to leaders who develop the highest level of human intelligence. Invest in and empower your talent. Sign up now to stream the event at leadercast.com.
Well, so let's take, this seems like a natural segue to the Enneagram. Let's make it about me for a minute if we can. So the Enneagram is hugely important to me. I found it through Richard Rohr was an early mentor of mine to help me sort of when I didn't think I had any faith anymore. He gave me words around faith so that I could process that. And I just stumbled upon his Enneagram book probably 17 years ago. It was a long time ago. And he's on our platform, by the way. I got to interview him last year in Albuquerque, and it was an awesome interview. And so for me, I did all this personality stuff, but to me, the thing about the Enneagram as a model is it feels like it's very much about your desires, your intention, your motivations, and a lot less about your personality per se. I know you know all that. Would you give just a quick overview of how you found the Enneagram and what it means to you, and how you might explain it to someone, say, on a 1-minute elevator ride, kind of what it is?
Well, I was in graduate school studying to become a psychotherapist, and I was on a retreat. At a Catholic retreat center, and I happened on Richard's book, and I read it, and I thought to myself, "Well, where the heck has this been? I've been studying psychology for at that point a year in a 2-year program, and no one has talked to me about this modality, right? This thinking about human personality development." And I was very taken with it by its simplicity, by how actionable it was. You know, over the years following that, I was in graduate school. I was doing so much stuff. I didn't have time to go do a deep dive into it. Over the years, I went to Ariso and Hudson training, and I went on a training with Richard. I did, some stuff over the years that followed, but I really didn't decide to do a super deep dive into it until about, 10 years ago, and really threw myself into it, which then led me to write The Road Back to You. And then the story of you. So those were the, that's sort of the journey of my thing with the Enneagram. Then, if somebody were to ask me, I just basically say to people the same thing all the time, which is that it's an ancient personality typing system that teaches there are 9 basic personality styles in the world. One of which we gravitate toward and adopt in childhood, just as a way to feel safe, to protect ourselves and to navigate the new world of relationships in which we find ourselves. And as you mentioned, each of those types has an underlying motivation and an unconscious motivation that powerfully influences how each of those types predictably and habitually acts, thinks, and feels from moment to moment on a daily basis. So that's my little elevator speech as to what this is, the Enneagram. And what it has meant to me, to answer your last question, is it's a wonderful portal way through which you can walk with another person into a conversation about the mystery of what it means to be a human being. I think the Enneagram is great. There's a quote in The Road Back to You from George Box, the statistician, and he says, "All models are wrong, but some are useful." And I'm like, that makes so much sense to me.
That is,
when you're talking about something, when you're talking about something as complex as the human person, the mystery of the human person, every model is wrong. Yeah. Whether it's Adlerian or it's Rogerian or it's Freudian or it's Jungian or it's behaviorist. It's just, all the models are wrong. Yeah. Some are useful. I think the Enneagram is particularly useful for helping people enter into conversation with the mystery of their own lives.
Could you say the quote one more time and who it was from?
George Box, a British statistician who says, "All models are wrong, but some are useful."
This is helpful because one of my very best friends is a clinical psychologist, and we have beers once a quarter. And we'll always end up talking about the Enneagram, and he will tell me it's fairy tale, it's ridiculous, there's no science that proves it. He gets very excited about that. And so I'm going to use that quote and just see what he does next time. He's one of my close friends, but we like to fight about the Enneagram, so it's fun. It's because he's an 8.
I've met some psychologists like that, but only some. I've met many others who are, have a great deal of respect for it. Just need to remind your friend. Well, first of all, there's actually a recent article in the journal of a major psychology journal about, doing a deep dive into the science of the Enneagram. That said, I just always tell people, look, anecdotal evidence is evidence. You can't downplay anecdotal evidence as evidence. You can argue with the science, but you can't argue with the millions and millions of people whose lives have been changed for the better because they've worked with the Enneagram.
Absolutely. And the conversation. What you said about there is a mystery to it. It's sort of founded by mystics in a way, right? And some people are very uncomfortable with even acknowledging mystery. There's that part of it, but life has mysteries. And it is a wonderful model to talk about that part of life. Exactly what you just said. You said it in words better I've ever been able to say it. But if two people sort of understand it, you can start talking about mysteries of life in a different way. And that's why I find it incredibly that it's useful, but that's what makes it fun to me. Like, we can have these conversations. Everything worth actually thinking and talking about has to have a metaphor in my mind to discuss. You can't talk about love or God or passion or anything without metaphors. So the Enneagram gives us this sort of metaphor. I do wonder, obviously, your recovery journey and then discovering, then rediscovering the Enneagram and becoming I mean, you would be seen as an Enneagram teacher expert in the world. How would you feel like your recovery journey marries up with the Enneagram? And maybe does it, do you feel like it gives you any sort of different sort of take or maybe kind of a different accent on the Enneagram and what it is?
Well, I mean, I think my recovery journey has been just so incredibly profound, so life and heart shaping. You know, and obviously it's had, I mean, just honestly, it's had far more effect on my life than the Enneagram ever has.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, the Enneagram didn't save my life.
Right.
you know, like literally, right.
Yeah. No, I got you.
That said, you know, look, you asked me earlier, you know, what would the sixth grader me think about my 62-year-old me? Okay. And everything in my early life was all about transcendence. And I would even say that part of my attraction to substances was the feeling of transcendence that they gave me.
Sure.
So, and even Carl Jung used to describe alcoholics as frustrated mystics. Hmm. And I think that there's some real truth to that, right? So when I look at the fact that, you know, I'm a therapist, I was an author, a speaker, a songwriter, a spiritual director, you know, all these things, I used to wonder, gosh, are you like vocationally confused? Like, what is it you actually do for a living? Then one day I realized, you know, well, what I do is I help people make contact with transcendent themes in their lives. Like, why am I here? What does any of this matter? What does my suffering mean? You know, how can I leverage suffering for something redemptive and helpful, generative for the world? These were the kinds of things I cared about even as a young kid. And so you write songs about those things and you write books about those things. And you become a priest and you go through certain liturgies and practices that help people. So everything I ever did became something that was all in service to that goal, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, my recovery journey and the Enneagram were just parts of those, you know, that repertoire of experiences and trainings that helped me enter into people's lives in such a way that I hoped to facilitate deep, deep change in the core of their person.
At LeaderCast, you know, we do these big, you've spoken at them, like these sort of events. Transcendent might be a strong word for them, but there is something that happens when you get in a room with a bunch of people focus on something and kind of get swept away in something, right? Which I think we call it like being spark, like having a spark. But often those moments don't actually change you. They just make you want to change. And so, you know, we've begun sort of thinking about the work that just people do in their life. There is spark work. You have to have those moments that make you want to change. And there's a shadow spark work too, where pain can do that, of course, but you can purposely have a spark. And then there's kind of teamwork where you, much like what you've done your whole life in your groups, where you have honest conversations with folks about getting better. And then there's also obviously solo work where you are with yourself. I'll just straight up ask you in front of everybody that's in our community, does that resonate as true to you that that's basically kind of how, say I wanted to be a better person or in our context, a better leader? Does it kind of make sense to say those are the three ways we're doing work? We're doing sort of transcendent spark work. We're doing community and then individual. Does that resonate with you?
Sure. There are lots of ways. You know, there are lots
Every model is flawed, Ian.
Yes.
Is it a useful model? Let me ask that. Is it a useful model?
Yeah, sure. It absolutely is.
Yeah.
It absolutely is. I mean, you know, I've heard lots of models for change. And I would say that most change, if not all change, isn't something you do. It's something that gets done to you as a result of your giving consent to some power greater than yourself to do for you what you've been unable to do for yourself. Now, that power may be the power of a community, that in which you find yourself. It may be in the form of your faith in some higher power, God, or whatever you choose to call it, right? Yeah. Or maybe some teaching like Buddhism. You know, it whatever it is, I think change has to be mostly the result of your consenting to something or someone greater than yourself who can do the lion's share of the work in your heart and in your mind. Most people make the mistake of thinking that all change is self-generated. Well, that's like self-help. Listen, if I could have helped myself, don't you think I would have? Right? I mean, you know, it's so ultimately, you want to be a better leader. There is a part of that journey of becoming a better leader that is about recognizing your powerlessness over your own defects of character that prevents you from becoming a great leader, and then turning those over to something or someone greater than yourself to help transform you into the leader you want to be, but can't be under your own self-management. You're looking at me like, what the hell did you just say?
You don't know me well. This is my look of, this is my truth bomb look. Like, every word you said the last 2 minutes resonates as totally true. And anytime somebody, it's 90% awe, 10% jealousy of anytime somebody puts something so beautifully into words that you just know is true. And what you just said to me, improv comedy. I quit being a pastor and got into improv comedy. I learned the tenets of improv comedy, and I get in trouble for saying this all the time. I was like, you know, I had to quit being a pastor to find my religion, is how I talked about improv. Cause it, I submitted to it. I submitted to yes. And I submitted to listening. I submitted to being part of a team and not an individual. And those things instantly started to change my life when I submitted to them. And I've never stopped. I still have my faith, but it's different than this sort of system I gave myself over to. And so I thought of that. And then of course I thought of, there's so many folks in the world that are, it's a balance, right? Cause so many of us are in the job of creating sort of those, creating or refining those systems that help other people change. And so it's humbling then to think of it as we actually can't change them and they can't change them, but we can create an opportunity for them to submit to be changed. And that is like, I only have a curse word to explain what you did to my mind. So I won't say it, but, I appreciate it. That was worth the price of this podcast, which is free on all platforms, but it's worth even more than that. So, hey, conclude with just a couple of things. So, kind of a serious question. There's folks going to be listening to this. A lot of them will know you. Many of them will not. The Road Back to You is the book of yours that I first read and loved. I know you have a new book, and I think you also might have some free resources. So all the details from that we got from your office, and they'll be in the description of the podcast, but if folks want to connect with you or if they want those free resources, could you let us know the best way to do that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously they can go to my website, which is ianmorgancron.com, ianmorgancron.com. And I think we've set up sort of an offering for your audience, right?
Yes. We'll get all those details to them.
Yeah, well, we have a brand new online course that just launched this week called The Enneagram in the Workplace. Because, you know, most of my work is done in the corporate space. It's not, like I mostly work with leaders, right?
Yeah.
And so folks can, you know, go to my website, Ian Morgan Cron, or they can go to typologyinstitute.com, which is, you know, sort of the umbrella piece for my resources. Yeah, yeah. And they can just use the discount code LeaderCast and they'll get 20% off on an annual subscription. And that gives them access to all three of my Enneagram courses.
Awesome.
And of course, Amazon for books, you know, all that stuff.
You can be found. Thank you so much. I try to ask one sort of fun question at the end. This is all I got is for Enneagram nerds, I guess. So you have to do a road trip from Nashville where you live to LA. And no type is better than the other, but you have to pick two strangers to go on this road trip with only by their Enneagram type. As a four, play the Enneagram lottery. Who are you going on the road trip with? Who's the best road trip partner? Let's assume they're reasonable.
Oh, Well, I would. My initial thought is a very healthy 9 would be awesome on a road trip. And a very healthy 7. So those two energies would be really fun to drive across the country.
That's awesome. I'm a 7. As soon as I get healthy, we'll go on a road trip. How's that?
We'll find a 9.
Oh, I got one. Ian, you're the best. Thank you so much. Your time is, it's humbling for me to be able to just have your time. And thank you so much for being a part of this.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Empower yourself and your team to tackle some of the most difficult leadership challenges and grow professionally with LeaderCast Now. The LeaderCast Now app, an online platform, provides you access to more than 1,000 video lessons to help you navigate issues like change management, remote working guidelines, emotional intelligence, workplace conflict, negotiating, and more. Visit LeaderCastNow.com for more info.